Hello and welcome to our very special Christmas episode of the Los Haro podcast. I'm your host, Eric Sayer, and joined by my other host, Arlen Haro.
Hi.
Also with us, Alan Muir, our sound engineer.
Hello.
So, we decided to talk about first non-traditional Christmas movie. So for this year's Christmas, we're doing a two-parter. This week would be non-traditional movies. So a lot of Shane Black, some Die Hard, some Gremlins, a lot of good stuff. And next week, we'll go into more the classics. So I don't know which ones are your favorites.
I mean, we'll probably cover some form of a Christmas Carol, probably. I can't remember what it's called, but
It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, It's a Wonderful Life. Yeah, probably. And there are a few others.
My favorite, Charlie Brown's Christmas.
Oh yeah, that's a great one.
So, but this week we're doing more, let's say, other genres of movies that are set during Christmas. So.
Mm-hmm. Christmas is more of a background.
Yeah, right? Exactly. I like Christmas as a setting for movies because it's like it's easy to relate to the time of the year. You can feel it immediately, like what every character is dealing with, like the presents part and the dinner part and all that. So it's easy. It makes it easy to relate to the characters fast, I feel.
Yeah.
Like.
And Christmas, I think, because a lot of our holidays now are so close together or they're separated very close together, it doesn't matter really what culture you're from. Like, even the Chinese New Year isn't that far away. So if you make a movie set in Christmas, it kind of extends to this, like, five-month period on either side of Christmas that a lot of people can relate to.
Yeah.
And like even like the Canadian Thanksgiving is in October, so Christmas sort of like it's this nice little waypoint that a lot of people have an attachment to, even if they don't celebrate it.
Yeah, exactly. So we can start with the director that sets his movie during Christmas the most, which is Shane Black. Mm-hmm. I think five of his movies at least, but the movies he's either written or directed are set.
The only one that I can think of really that like just comes to mind automatically is his most recent one, Nice Guys. But otherwise, I can't think of one.
That's not Christmas. Christmas.
Yeah, I'd have to look it up. I'd have to go to the old IMDb to know which ones they are. Because otherwise, I'm like, oh, that takes place during Christmas. That takes place during Christmas. He didn't write any of the Lethal Weapon sequels, so none of them take place during Christmas.
Yeah.
Lethal Weapon is...
What about Iron Man 3?
That takes place during Christmas.
That's one of the ones I feel we're going to talk about the most.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to talk about a bit about Lethal Weapon? I haven't seen it, so I can't really...
Oh. So Lethal Weapon it's kind of the movie that started Shane Black. I'm sure he did things before that. And he's done a lot of stuff, so it's really hard to narrow him down. But Lethal Weapon is like, it's 2 years before Die Hard, and it's sort of a late 80s action movie. And in a way, I'm trying to think of a good comparison. It's not quite The Heat, which is a more recent movie that's kind of making fun of the buddy cop thing, but it's definitely more self-aware than any of the other buddy cop movies. It knows what the tropes are. Danny Glover's line, his iconic line from the movies is, "I'm getting too old for this shit." Which is kind of a reference to how there's always one partner who's older than the young guy in the adventure. And Mel Gibson is playing I'm the crazy guy, which is kind of a cliche at this point. But at the time, it was very fresh, and it was very new. And again, it's very much commenting on those movies, and it's also taking it one step a little bit darker and a little bit more into the superhero genre, almost. Like, Mel Gibson chases after a car at one point, and you really believe that he might catch up to this car. One of the big bads of the movie, sort of the bad tough guy who works for the criminals, is I cannot remember, Gary Busey. And he there's a very fun scene in this movie where he just holds his hand over a lighter and feels no pain. Like, it's very comic booky and pulpy, but it also takes place at Christmas. And sorry about that. Part of why it takes place at Christmas is because Mel Gibson's backstory is a very sad one. And Christmas acts as sort of this redeeming factor for him, in that he is kind of starting to bond with Danny Glover through this story, and with Danny Glover's family. And that's something that plays out in the later movies. By the time Lethal Weapon 2 comes around, by the end of it, he's like the uncle to Danny Glover's very large family. And so the movie is really about him dealing with the loss of his family, his wife, who died, I believe, a year earlier on Christmas. So there's a lot of this movie where he's walking around very sad that it's Christmas. He's very sad that people are singing Christmas songs. He gets into a bar fight with a guy who's very happy that it is Christmas time. So that's sort of how Christmas plays in the movie. It's this sort of haunting aspect for our lead character, who just hates Christmas. And by the end of the movie, spoilers, he learns to love it because he's found a new family, found a new place to be. So, hope that gets people to go watch Lethal Weapon.
No, I will. I really need to watch it. So, I think the next big Shane Black film that's his directorial debut, which is takes Christmas a little bit less seriously, maybe, I feel like, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. And Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is a very Hollywood story with a very LA Christmas. So, like, there's no the thing we usually associate with Christmas aren't there, except like the setting, I feel like.
It is interesting. A lot of his movies take place in LA. Right.
Yeah.
A lot of them. And he does avoid a lot of the things, a lot of the visual things that you do associate with Christmas, like the decorations and stuff. Yeah, so
I don't know. Maybe I don't know enough about Shane Black, but maybe he's he doesn't himself associate maybe Christmas with snow, because that's not where he was raised, but I don't know.
I don't know.
He's a Pittsburgh guy, so no snow.
Yeah, but you're right, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, it's very like I feel like that's much more what an LA Christmas would be like when I watch that movie.
A very Hollywood rich type LA Christmas.
And it's a noir movie, really. Like, it's not really an action movie. I think it's become clear that he likes action, but he prefers noir stories. He prefers stories where the good guys aren't necessarily the best people, and you can tell because he just embraces that noir aspect of it. So,
and it does give him a larger marge to build on characters that would, like, characters with faults that are trying to be good, or characters with good traits but that end up bad. So it's always Robert Downey Jr.'s character in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang is a great example of sometimes he's incredibly shitty and sometimes he does the right thing because he believes in it, and it's I don't know, it makes for more more character building and more fun movies.
Yeah, definitely. And and what I like is, I might be misremembering the movie, but he's dealing with being an alcoholic in the movie, if I'm not remembering incorrectly. And he's got like real demons and stuff, and he's not the most successful guy, and it's interesting the way that plays out. And it also kind of comments on real life in a way. I haven't seen the movie in far too long, but
it's more about him. It's not about him struggling with the fact that he's not really great. He's like he hasn't really done anything, and then he meets a girl and lies about being a detective.
Yeah.
which is a pretty great setting for a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Shane Black also, in his later movies, he likes to play with the fourth wall a bit. You know, if you've seen Iron Man 3, you know this, but the movie opens with Tony Stark talking to the camera. And he does a very similar thing in Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. It opens with a flashback to like when he was a kid, and then there's voiceover from Tony Stark sort of stop that. Oh, pay attention here or whatever. I really need to rewatch this movie now, because it's a movie that I think about a lot, but I never actually get a chance to go back to. But he plays with the audience a lot in that movie, and he really milks that to make something that's kind of surprising and that you're not able to predict very well. Like, there are moments in the movie where you're like, oh, Robert Downey Jr. might die right now. which is something that's always surprising in a movie like this, where it could be very easy to just have the good guy walk away victorious, you know, scot-free at the end, and he saved the day, and blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't go for that. It sort of subverts your expectations a little.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's a good transition to talk about maybe Iron Man 3, which is a much more positive movie.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of has to be because it's a Marvel film.
Right.
And I rewatched it recently, and I still think it's like one of the best Marvel films. I hadn't watched it since its release, and I loved it in the theaters.
Mm-hmm.
It's in Iron Man 3, Tony Stark is a mess. He has PTSD, he can't sleep, he's losing himself in his work and antagonizing Pepper Potts,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah.
Yeah, and everybody, yeah. Really.
Everybody, yeah.
Everybody around him has to deal with his...
Yeah.
His bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. And it's... And he... Yeah, you say bullshit, but at the same time, it's like... He's really... The Avengers events really fucked him up, and it's...
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And then it's... And at the same time, again, it's another movie set during Christmas, and it's supposed to be happy and supposed to be a time for family, and he can't be with the person he loves because he feels too much like a mess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I don't know, it's one of the rare Marvel movies where there really feels like there's a character arcs, not just character moments.
I agree with that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Because what the Marvel movies tend to do is the arc isn't in one movie, it's over multiple movies. And I do think it's interesting that movie, yes, there's the larger arc of Tony Stark, who has turned from the guy who will tell the government to their face, no, you have to kill me in order to get my suit from me, to the guy who will willingly sign up to join the UN and their special task force for people with an advantage over others, let's say. And that change is something that's gradually happened over multiple films. And that's a larger arc, but this movie has, like, no, he's in one place at the beginning of this movie, and at the end he's in another place. And that is unique. The closest thing you can come to that is in Winter Soldier, Cap goes from being unsure of what he's doing to being the most sure about what he's doing that he possibly could be. But they really don't like to do that much. And I do like, you point something out, that, you know, this is the movie where they deal most with somebody having to live with what happened in the Avengers.
Somebody that's, like, not normal, but normal-ish.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's really easy to empathize with Tony Stark in this film, because he's a human that deals with people we didn't really have a choice and mm-hmm. did what he had to do. And he's not a soldier like Hawkeye or Captain America, and he's not a mm-hmm. god, and he's just a dude that, for all intents and purposes, believed he was killing himself to save New York.
Yeah, and he's really dealing with that in a way that only that character can really deal with it. You know, Hulk doesn't have to deal with the eternal or the internal emotions of what he did. And Cap is Cap, and he's a soldier, and he can just wash it off. And like you said, Thor is a god. So for him, the Battle of New York is just every other day for him.
Right, exactly. Another century.
Yeah. And it's just like, you know, whatever. I don't get PTSD or whatever, you know. And I like that they take advantage of that in this movie.
Yeah.
Even if I don't think the PTSD arc, I think that kind of goes away a little bit too quickly, and it doesn't play a big enough role in the rest of the movie. But I still like that they thought about it, and they considered it, and they didn't just wipe that away. Because he's the only character at the time you can really do that with. There are other characters later down the line that they can do that with, and I would be very interested to see if they do. You know, I'd really love to see Ant-Man 3 deal with, you know, I can't remember his name, but dealing with the current Ant-Man dealing with PTSD because of Thanos and all that stuff.
Oh, you mean Scott Lang?
Yeah, Scott Lang. I would love to see him dealing with, like, I was in space. I was fighting aliens. How do I comprehend that? I'm a guy who shrinks to the size of a, you know, an ant. What was I doing there? And so that's the kind of thing that they could visit again, but I don't think that they will. So I do think it's important to point out that they did that and they tried in this movie, and it was well done what they did do.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they kind of disregarded everything in Avengers 2.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
there's
a certain line I like from this movie where Tony says, "A hostile alien army charged through a hole in space," and he says he quickly just says, "We're standing 300 feet below it."
Yeah, was that in Ultron or was that in Iron Man 3?
It was in, I think, I'm pretty sure it was the scene where Pepper is...
You're right. Yeah, that was...
When he's working on the suits.
That's a great scene. Like, his performance in that scene and her performance, she's reacting to it like somebody who, if you said that to them, how they would react to it. You know, she's not treating it like just another day at the office.
Also,
and that's what Gwyneth Paltrow brings her all in this movie.
Yeah.
They also did there was a change in this in Iron Man 3 that they acknowledged carrying over to Avengers Age of Ultron. And that was the Tony having the surgery for the shrapnel near his heart.
Mm, yeah. Yeah,
which Joss Whedon was not happy about.
Yeah. They dealt with it, though. Yeah. But yeah, I do like this movie. I like the way that it ends.
I like the part in the middle with the kid, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
I like the kid a lot, too.
Yeah, the kid's great, and it's the moment when he starts dealing with himself and the kid helps, and it's also the moment when one of the moments when he feels the most fucked up, when he has anxiety attacks just from talking to the kid like a few times, and I didn't even remember that part. And
in the beginning with Rhodey?
Yeah, think so.
But he, like, a couple of times with the kid, actually, he can't breathe, and he's having a panic attack, and he's... It comes back, like, a few times in the movie, and it's really... You know, it's really a lot more depth, a lot darker than, I feel like, Marvel movies tend to approach those subjects.
Yeah, I think it is much darker, and, I really like the kid, too, and I just gotta say this. People treat that kid like he's like every other bad kid in every other movie with a bad kid in it. He's really not. He's funny, and he's got, like, he's a well-performed kid, and kids are usually very bad. And people just lump him in with every other kid, and that always bothers me. And this movie has so many people that are just completely wrong about it. I don't want to go too deep into that stuff,
No, I agree. I think the twist of the movie is one of my favorite Marvel moments.
Yes, it's one of the best.
Yeah.
It's one of the best, yeah, but people get so angry.
Yeah, as someone that doesn't care about comics at all, Ben Kingsley, drunk, watching football, it's perfect.
It's really good. Here's the thing. It's not even just comics people. It's like they got upset that the trailer kind of was mismarketing, which I understand. I've gotten angry over mismarketing before myself. But within the context of the movie, it really, really works.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. And also, like, I'm sorry. A Chinese man with magic rings, they've done nothing by that point in 2013 to set that up in a way that it fits in the universe. Even a Middle Eastern man with magic rings, which is what we assumed that they would have been going for. Again, they've done nothing to set that up, and that's kind of an important thing. You kind of need to establish these things. You got to remember, in 2013, there was no Doctor Strange. Magic wasn't really a thing. Loki got his powers from science, basically, just very advanced science. So, like, a lot of people complained about that. It's like, you can't really do the Mandarin on screen accurately and have him be the way he is in the comics. Like, and people got really upset about that. So,
do you remember in the first Thor movie when he says to Jane Foster, "Where I come, science and magic are one and the same."
And yes, then, we all saw the trailer, Alan.
Then it just, I would just want to see that scene, then cut to Doctor Strange, where Steven is learning about all the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, yeah. So I feel like that kind of establishes it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it kind of gives people an idea of what we're talking about. Shane Black, Christmas is in the movies. It's not the main aspect of the movies, but it plays some sort of thematic role in the background, less than in the front, where everybody can see it. I feel like that gives an idea for the other non-traditional movies we'll bring up.
So I feel we can move on to maybe... I think the one movie that's the most brought up in when you talk about non-traditional movies, and that's Die Hard.
Yes. And
what many call the best action movie ever made. I'm not sure if I agree, but it's up there.
It's always in the conversation.
Yeah.
And it's a John McTiernan film, and John McTiernan's widely considered, if you put all of his films together, the best director who's ever directed modern action movies.
Rollerball.
Well, here's the problem. Any director who started from the 60s to the 80s, any of them, later in their career, their films get really bad. I'll have to look up the movie, but a film that actually kind of plays into this, Reindeer Games, that movie is directed by... Give me a sec. But that movie is directed by, I believe, the director of The Exorcist. So, yeah. Oh. You cannot... Yep. So you cannot judge directors based off their last movies.
Yeah, I did not see that coming.
So yeah, never. Yeah, John Frankenheimer, who, if he didn't direct The Exorcist,
Friedkin did direct The Exorcist, no?
Frankenheimer did, what did he do? Frankenheimer directed some, like,
Dementia and Candidate, Seven Days in May, Birdman of Alcatraz,
mm-hmm.
French
Ronin,
Connection.
Yeah. But towards the end of his career, he's responsible for Reindeer Games and The Island of Dr. Monroe, which he's not responsible. There's a documentary about that movie, so you should all watch that. Don't listen to me about that one. But, yeah, he's responsible for some great movies from, you know, long past, some great movies from the 50s and the 60s, and, you know, even The French Connection 2, which is not considered a bad movie. So yeah, that's the thing. So directors in their later careers get bad, but John McTiernan is probably one of the better ones. And Die Hard is his follow-up to Predator, which is it's amazing that that's the follow-up to another great action movie.
Another great action movie written by Shane Black?
No. I believe so. A draft was, at least.
Yeah.
One
of the writers.
He's also in the film. He's the guy who makes the joke to Chief that makes him laugh. And it's the laugh that the Predator copies throughout the movie.
No, he's just both.
Yeah,
he's credited as a script doctor. Anyway, go ahead.
See. Yeah, Die Hard, generally considered one of the better action movies of all time. Here's the thing: I think a lot of movies have done it just as well since, but I think that there's like a clear turning point from pre-Die Hard and post-Die Hard in that. Post Die Hard, you have all these movies that are just Die Hard, but with a twist. So you have some of the better ones like Speed, which is Die Hard on a bus. And then you have other movies what's the one that I'm thinking of? Like Olympus Has Fallen, which is Die Hard in the White House. So this is like a subgenre that was created by Die Hard. And that's why a lot of people call it the best action movie of all time, because it created this subgenre almost, and most of them are really just copying this movie, and you'll notice they never really change anything. They never really stray from the formula, because the better job that you do of copying this movie, the better the movie is, to be fair. So I think that's why people give it the credit that they do.
I think the reason I like this movie the most, I feel, is the strength of both the main character and the villain.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Bruce Willis is a great, everyday guy. He's so good at being that in films, like being just a regular dude. He's not like... Mm-hmm. Super good looking, super in shape, super all that, like a lot of action stars from before that. He's not Sylvester Stallone or or Arnold Schwarzenegger. He's like more everyday guy, and he's
Like he's somehow more everyday guy than even Harrison Ford. And I think the main difference there is Harrison Ford is handsome. Like he is like he is old school movie star handsome, and that's what separates the two. And Bruce Willis is I've been punched in the face, so what? Handsome.
He's great, and he's like it's so easy to root for him, like in this movie and in almost every movie he's in. Or at least in that era of Bruce Willis. Recently, it's a bit. He's more of a, I don't know, your dad if you're older, your granddad that's like kind of still there and still want to have a few beers with you.
So perfect. Like he's just that's so good. Like the last movie he was in that's like that's good and it's good not in spite of him is Looper.
He's great in Looper.
And that's because he's bringing back what made him good in Die Hard, this sense of like this is just a guy that I couldn't meet. I could know this person. And I think that is what makes Die Hard good is you may not know a John McClane, but you could. And that's what makes it interesting. And that's what kind of, in the times where they have tried to copy this and they've failed, it is because they cast somebody who's like, I've never met that person. I don't know that person. I could never know that person. You know, I will never meet anybody who looks like Gerard Butler, ever. Like, that man doesn't exist everywhere in the world. But we all have met a Bruce Willis, or we've seen a Bruce Willis type walking down the street, and maybe even had a conversation with somebody like that. And I think that's what makes Die Hard work, is he's just so real and believable. You know, even in scenes where he's very sad and shaken and upset over a guy he does not like, the Cokehead guy who tries to make a deal with Hans Gruber, R.I.P. Alan Rickman. But yeah, and he's shaken after that character, spoilers, dies. After that character is deceased, you just see it in his face, and it's a character that he has no reason to mourn, but he does it so well, and he plays it so just authentically. And it really helps the movie work and helps it hold up years down the road.
Yeah, and Alan Rickman is great as Hans Gruber. He's just like a, you know, just kind of like evil feeling enough. Mm-hmm. Like not to the, like a bit funny, but not like ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And a bit like the good level of evil for an action film.
He's slimy, but not so slimy that you're like, that's not a real person.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't think I've seen a bad Alan Rickman movie.
I think that's fair. Or at least I haven't seen a movie where he is bad in it. I don't think he ever overcooks it. No. He's good in Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, but he's chewing on the scenery. If you haven't seen that movie, I highly recommend.
Yeah, it's
because
great.
It's ridiculous, but it's worth watching for the Rickman in that. But yeah, like his Hans is so, again, he's believable. You feel like you could know this person, you know, and like I love his line, a thief. No, not just a thief, an excellent thief. like he's just so up on himself and so proud of himself for even thinking of that line to say. I love it. The character work is so good, and him and Bruce Willis have this weird chemistry when they're on screen that is hard to look away from. And like,
no, they're both like really great actors, and it feels like, I don't know, they did really pair off really well. Like, the classical British actor dude with the, like, the most American actor in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. It works very well.
Yeah.
Like, I think my favorite stuff is when he meets Hans, but he doesn't know it's Hans yet. Which is something that, when you're a kid, you don't really understand the context of it. But when you go back and watch it, the tension between the two of them is perfect. Like, the weird American accent that Alan Rickman puts on.
Yeah.
don't shoot me! It's so good. Yeah, like, that stuff is great, and you just feel him, like, Bruce Willis asks him, you know, what floor are you on, or what's your name, and he looks at the sign that's behind him, and you're not sure when Bruce Willis clocks him, or when they clock each other, because at one point they both realize who each other's real identity is, and it's just so tense up until the point where it's revealed, and it's great. So yeah, another good non-traditional Christmas movie.
Yeah, I think we're now gonna move to a completely different kind of movie, a horror movie a bit, a comedy a bit, a weird movie about small creatures, Gremlins. Mm-hmm. Gremlins is another non-traditional Christmas movie about small creatures called Mogwai that you must never feed after midnight and should never be exposed to water, or they'll turn into gremlins and kill you and make it look like an accident. I don't know. Yep. Do you like this movie?
I do, actually. I like this movie quite a bit. Gremlins is like it's a classic in my family. Like, it's a movie that's been, like, passed down from my mom to me. It's kind of strange. Like, it's a multi-generational Christmas movie for my family. And it's weird because there's always been this fight in my family over whether or not this is a Halloween movie or a Christmas movie. And it's widely considered to be both, and part of why we like it so much is, well, I guess we have 3 months to watch this movie before we wear out its welcome, which is nice. Although I usually make a choice, am I going to watch it in October or am I going to watch it in December, now that I'm an adult and I have to make adult choices like this?
The most adult choice you'll make, yeah.
Yeah. This year, it's going to be my December, but it's a great movie. I don't know what to say about it other than I love it so much. Like, it's influenced a lot of things. It's early in that 80s time zone where they were making more movies about kids and about younger people, and they weren't just movies about teenagers getting killed. Like, throughout,
it feels like it's kind of a horror movie, but it really feels made for kids in a way that really surprised me a lot. I just watched it for the first time.
And
I feel like if I had watched that movie when I was younger, I'd have liked it more. Yeah. If I had watched it too young, I'd have been terrified.
I think that's fair, because there are moments in that movie when you're a kid that are terrifying. Like, and
when they kill people and make it look like an accident, it's like they use the chair to kill the lady, and they use they make the snowplow go through the house like they're smart, and that's what makes them scary when they are scary. Also, they're just completely ridiculous. The scene in the bar, the scene in the theater. I don't think I'd have liked those scenes as much if I had seen them as a kid. They're, like, just completely ridiculous.
I love it, though, because it's so obvious that they're doing, like, Looney Tunes with it. And they go full Looney Tunes in the second one. But, like, I love it. The cartooniness of it, I think it works really well because these characters are so smart. Because they are like these smart little creatures. And it's interesting because they're based off of this very strange mythology that actually goes back, I guess, very, very long into the past. But specifically for this movie, it comes from this thing that the old man who knows about the monsters, it comes from this thing in World War II where, and it's a common thing among World War II pilots, where you thought that your plane had gremlins on it when something went wrong. And there's a well-recorded story about a flight where there was only one survivor, and if you asked him, he would claim that the rest of the flight and everybody on his flight was taken by gremlins. So yeah, like, it's based off this very strange bit of mythology that they sort of repurposed to be these creatures that just wreck everything they come in touch with. And it's just it's a very fun movie, and I do suggest, like, if you have kids and they're like, I want to say 6 or up, show it to them and they will love it. Like, the stuff with the mom alone in the house is still kind of freaky even now. The moment she hears the music.
Yeah, but I love how she deals with it and just fucks up a couple of gremlins. It's really funny.
Like, when she shoves that one in the microwave.
Yeah. No, it's great. When she charges with it, she's using the thing as a shield and a sword. And she's like a, it looks like a knight. And she stabs it in the face. No, yeah, that's good. The best part. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Okay. No, I was just going to say, I feel like the reason I didn't enjoy the movie as much as I wish I did because every actor is really bad.
that's very fair.
Yeah, like, the main character, like, he sucks.
He really does.
Yeah,
he really, really does. Phoebe Cates is not doing her best. No. The dad is really bad.
The dad is like funny bad, like he works. Yeah. I feel like more than I like the dad, and the mom's great just because of that scene. But the Phoebe Cates and I don't remember the protagonist's name, but he's like really bad too.
Billy,
yeah.
Yeah, it's Zach. I think it's Zach Galligan. I can't remember. Corey. I think it's Corey Feldman. Young Corey Feldman, future star of the Goonies. he's bad in it. I like the cops a lot, and I like the neighbor. I think that they are actually doing a very good job. The neighbor has been in a number of movies. If you've seen any Roger Corman movie, or a significant number of them, you've seen him in other stuff before. He's like a well-known B-movie actor. So he's fun to watch, but you're right. Like, the entire rest of this cast is bad, except for the radio jockey.
Yeah,
was there throughout the whole movie?
Yeah,
there's a whole other movie about that radio jockey, and like the station gets attacked by gremlins at one point, and you're just hearing them tear apart the station. And it's great because the radio jockey is still there at the end of the night.
No, so at the end he's like, I made it through.
So like, yeah, I love imagining the movie where it's just the radio jockey fighting gremlins, and he's dressed like he is in the posters and stuff. So yeah, it's a fun movie to watch. Definitely if you have kids.
Yeah. Have
you two ever seen the Key and Peele skit on Gremlins 2?
Yes, I have.
I haven't.
It's much funnier after you've seen Gremlins 2.
Yeah,
I'll watch Gremlins 2 because I hear it's more of a comedy, and I'm down for that. Yeah,
it's like a Deadpool kind of.
Yeah. The only scene I wanted to talk about because it's when when Billy and Phoebe Kid's character make it to the bank and she starts telling him about her dad, how her dad died.
Yeah.
Doing another shimmy. And it was just, I couldn't believe it.
It's such a dark scene.
Yeah, like he was pretending.
It's so funny.
He was pretending to be Santa Claus. He fell down the stairs and didn't he break his neck or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He fell, broke his neck, and that's why I don't believe it. So good.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a, like, really serious scene, and I couldn't.
It was taking like, the complete opposite.
What I was watching. Yeah, it's like, no, it's it feels so out of place in the movie and so weird, and I don't know. It's definitely a weird movie.
Mm-hmm. Definitely watch it. Especially if you haven't watched any other Joe Dante movies. He's got a very interesting career to observe, so.
Okay, so do you want to talk a bit about Krampus?
Well, it actually fits perfectly, so I just watched it today, because it was available, and it kind of fits what we're talking about. Krampus is kind of like a, I don't want to say it's a remake or a sequel, but it's in the same vein as Gremlins. Like, I wish I could say it's like Gremlins, but it's a little bit darker, a little bit gorier. No, it's if you've seen Gremlins, you've seen this kind of movie. It's more in line with Army of Darkness, though, or any sort of Sam Raimi movie, but it's basically what happens when kids are bad. What happens when you forget about Christmas, or you forget about what Christmas means, and Santa Claus ain't coming this year, and Santa Claus's evil brother shows up, and it very much takes that to its most violent and horrifying ends, and it makes for a very interesting movie with a lot of great creature effects. And it's, I think it holds up pretty well. It's only a couple years old now, but it's very weird, and it's very universal. The commentary it's making on, you know, when you have to have your family over for dinner, you know, and you're in the liberal household, you know, it's very progressive, and your family members maybe aren't so progressive.
I have a question for you too. Have you guys ever actually received coal for Christmas?
No.
Alan?
I have.
No. Oh, whoa. Okay.
Okay.
That's,
my grandma.
Okay, that makes sense.
She did some, she gave coal to all four of us.
Interesting. Yeah, that's pretty crazy, Alan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I thought it was just like a old movie thing.
No, it is real.
I guess it was a real thing because it was a legitimate present to give. It wasn't always a bad thing. It was like, you have coal, so we have fire.
Yeah, over time it became a bad thing.
Yeah. But it used to be like a legitimate present to give people. So, yeah, Krampus is an interesting movie. It is very Gremlins-esque. And it's an interesting movie to watch. I definitely wouldn't show it to kids now. I guess that is the major difference. It isn't as kid-friendly. But, yeah.
Directed by the director of the Godzilla sequel. I don't know if you knew that.
Yeah. I knew that. And it's also,
yeah. Which is interesting, to go from horror to Godzilla. I'm definitely curious about Krampus. It looks like, I like horror comedies in general, the ones I've seen, so I'll probably watch it maybe for Christmas. I want to talk about another movie set during Christmas, which is Tangerine. Tangerine is a very, very indie movie. So a movie made on a $100,000 budget.
Wow.
Yep.
Yeah. It's a movie. It's set in L.A. In Hollywood, on the main, one of the most known avenues in L.A. I don't remember. I don't really know L.A. But it's set in a partially in a donut shop that's super well known.
Mm-hmm.
Tangerine is a movie about two transgender sex workers, two black transgender sex workers, Cinderella and Alexandra. Cindy just got out of prison and meets her friend Alexandra, and she gets out on Christmas Eve, and I love this movie. It's a drama, but also it's a drama comedy, like between the two, because it's mm-hmm. the character of Cindy is like she has so much energy. She's super funny. She just got out of jail and she wants to fuck up her pimp. So it's that part of the movie. It's like really. Like I said, it's funny at times. It's movie very much about.
Is it that dark? Is it like black humor?
No, not really. It's more like when they're jokes, they're jokes. Like it's very much a drama with some comedy fit in. But it's the tone throughout is very
serious.
It's more lighthearted than it seemed. Talking about the subject matter, it's. Like I said, the music is like very dubstepy, and it's like I said, it's shot with. I don't know if I said it. It's all shot with an iPhone 5 with a special lens, so it has a super stylized look with the dubstep and the Cindy walking angrily to the streets, ready to fuck up anyone in her way. It's those parts of the movies are like. Very, very good and very, like, I love the tone of that part. And the other part of the movie, because it's very much two stories that intersect, it's a middle-aged man, a middle-aged father from a... He's a taxi driver from, I think it's an... Iranian family, but I'm not sure. It might be somewhere else in the Middle East, but I think, if I remember well, it's from Iran, and he's a taxi driver with a wife and kids that's attracted to trans prostitutes. So he's one of Alexandra, there's Cindy right. and there's Alexandra. He's one of Alexandra's clients, and he saw Cindy once, and he like really wants to hire her. I'll say it like that. And like I said, the movie is set during Christmas, so it's Christmas dinner with his family, and he said he uses work as an excuse to not be there at first, and then he learns that Cindy is out of jail, so he wants to find her. It's all that part is a lot like more serious, it changes how the movie is shot. It's shot a lot darker, not the same kind of music, and I don't know, both parts feel really contrasted. One feels like hyper stylized, and the other part is like super serious, super like in natural colors. And it's a great, I won't talk more about how it ends and the spoiler, but get into spoilers, but it's a really, really great movie. It's great, like I said, super funny, great tone, great, super well shot for a movie shot on a... Like, if I hadn't known it was shot on an iPhone, I would have known.
Yeah, yeah. I remember hearing about this movie a lot back when it was at Sundance. And it's a movie that I've always had an interest in watching. It's just, you know, Netflix. It's just, there's so much stuff to watch. There's too much to watch. But it's definitely a movie that, it's always been on my list, and it's always been in the background. But actually hearing more about it makes me a little bit more interested to go see it. And I'm interested to see how Christmas does play a part in the movie, if at all. And it sounds like it does have some elements. Yes, some that does add something to it. So.
It ends in a very, like, oh, it's Christmas.
Right.
Way.
I see.
Which I like a lot. It's honestly, it's one of my favorite movies of the last few years, and it's definitely, like, I'd watch it. And like I said, I was expecting something a lot more serious, I guess, a lot more dark. But it kind of is dark, but it's not, like, it's a movie that's also enjoyable to watch. Like, it's also fun to watch. It's not like a hard one of the like as hardcore as its plot makes you think it'd be.
Yeah, that subject matter is one that you would expect to be very serious and very, like, I don't want to say self-important, but I feel like that's something that you might expect. I don't know, but so yeah.
It's also, like, last thing I'll say, it's both main characters, like Cindy and Alexandra, they're both played by actual transgender sex workers from LA. Like, Sean Baker, the director, he casted actual people from the place and the job to act like people from the place and the job, and it feels like they both give, like, amazing performances.
I'm definitely more interested in seeing it now. I guess we can do...
Sounds like something from Soderbergh.
Yeah, it does, actually, now you say that. And we don't want to go too long, but I'll just list off a couple other movies that I was thinking of that are interesting. One that I listed is Batman Returns. And it's actually got more to do with Christmas than you might think. So that's an interesting movie to watch, I guess, if you're curious about Christmas. It's the only superhero movie I can find other than Iron Man 3 that really takes place at Christmas, in, like, the traditional Christmas setting also. So that's interesting.
If we're going older, I kind of really like The Apartment, which is, like, a very much a dark comedy about a sad man during Christmas.
That sounds like the best thing ever, especially on Christmas.
Yeah.
I do think it's interesting. Sad stories watched in the context of Christmas are kind of more interesting in some ways. And I don't know why, but it just seems to be, you know, a sad story seems to take on a different aspect to it.
Especially, like, it's really about loneliness, and loneliness during Christmas kind of feels worse, because it's like Christmas is supposed to be such a family and people we love moment, and then
I do think that that's why sadness kind of hits people a lot harder around then. That's interesting. That's really the only other one that I can think of that's really Christmassy that sort of fits into this. Okay, so we're hitting about an hour, so I guess, Eric, do you have any, like, final things you want to say about non-traditional Christmas movies, maybe?
I think I honestly like non-traditional Christmas movies more than Christmas movies, because I don't really like Christmas movies, but I think we're going to talk about this more next week.
Yeah, and it is interesting, because I kind of share the same thoughts. I enjoy Christmas movies on a very nostalgic level more often than not. I don't enjoy them because they are actually good a lot of the time, which is something I always have a hard time admitting to myself. But I do watch them a lot of the time just because it reminds me of the feeling of Christmas. And that's what I enjoy from them. But so many of them are very saccharine to a point where it becomes unwatchable to me a lot of the time. And it, like, loses its purity somehow. It goes too sweet to the point where it becomes, like, just too exaggerated. What's the word I'm thinking of? Exploitation. It becomes exploitative of the audience. It's so sweet and saccharine and unnatural at certain points in some Christmas movies for me. So, and we can get more into that there, but I do think you're right. Like, sometimes these non-traditional Christmas movies,
they can get into they can get into the themes without being like so sugary and sweet about it.
Mm-hmm. Like, they can still have the same message of togetherness and a feeling of brotherhood, or, you know, whatever, without making it just the point of what you're watching. And I think that A Wonderful Life kind of stretches a little bit, and it's a little bit of both. It's got elements of a non-traditional Christmas movie, but at the end, it hits it really hard on the head that this is supposed to be a Christmas movie. So that'll be an interesting thing to discuss.
I will be bringing up the Star Wars Holiday Special.
No, you fucking
won't. Yes, I will!
Alan, you're banned from the show. I'll find a new engineer.
Okay, I feel like this is a good moment to wrap up.
Yep.
Where can people find you, Arlen?
You can find me, all sorts of places. Basically, I'll just do Twitter and Instagram at AAHaro. Also, I'm kind of thinking of moving away from Twitter a little bit, moving more towards Tumblr for some of my weirder esoteric posts that I like to make that make no sense to anybody but me. And moving those to Tumblr. So if you want more of that, spacecolumbo.tumblr.com. Follow me there. Get my thoughts on things. Yay!
Alan, anything you want to plug?
You can follow me on Twitter at UnworthyMirror. You can follow me on Instagram at ComicsBoy. Please listen and subscribe to Phantom Zone and Video Game Hour.
Yeah, should definitely listen to the next Video Game Hour. It's a fun episode. I wonder who was on that episode, Alan.
You were.
Yay! And we talked about Night Trap, which is the most fun I've had in a very long time.
And the when it comes episode to video games. And the episode art is truly frightening.
Yep. So yeah, I look forward to that.
Okay, you can find me on Twitter at ESAYOUR, Easier, and thanks for listening, and see you next week.
Bye.